how are we relating the first resurrection with the idea of the two births, right? So I mentioned Martin Luther's little notation in his journal, born twice, die once, born once, die twice. And so I think the way that I was discussing that maybe was confusing, or maybe it was how I crafted the notes. It was confusing. And so let me make sure I can clarify that, and then, Lord willing, we'll improve that section of the notes and do better next time. There are, biblically speaking, what we could call two births, a physical birth and a spiritual birth. The physical birth when we are born of our mother, the spiritual birth when we are born anew, born again of the Spirit, right? There are two deaths. The physical death, when the body and the soul are separate, the spirit departs to be with Christ, the body remains in the grave. The spiritual death that we see at the end of Revelation chapter 20, being cast into the lake of fire, being cast into hell. This is, John says, the second death. But there are also two resurrections, and this is where maybe it got confusing before. There is, notice that the reversal, there is a spiritual resurrection and a physical resurrection. Now, this actually touches on the very thing we're going to be talking about today. Dispensationalism would say, no, there are going to be two resurrections, and they are going to be literal bodily resurrections, and there are going to be multiple ones of them, okay? I'm going to argue that that's not the case. But at the very least, we would say, all of us would agree, that there are two resurrections in this way. There is a spiritual resurrection, and there is a physical resurrection. The spiritual resurrection is what I think we see in Revelation chapter 20 and verse 6. Those who had been beheaded for the testimony of Jesus Christ, the saints, are raised and seated on thrones to reign with Christ for 1,000 years. It does not say that they will be seated on a throne in Jerusalem. It does not say that they will reign in an earthly kingdom. It says that they will be raised with Christ and reign with Christ for the millennium, for the 1,000 years, right? I understand that, or maybe I misunderstand that, depending on your point of view. I understand that to be a reference to the new birth, to the spiritual resurrection of those who were once dead in sin. And the way that I explained this was to say, what you have portrayed in this figurative way in Revelation chapter 20 is actually taught and explained in Ephesians 2, verses 1 through 10, and particularly verses 1 through 7, where he says, you were dead in your trespasses and sins, but God made you alive. He raised you up with Christ and seated us with Christ in heavenly places in the spiritual realm. Well, that is exactly what Revelation chapter 20 is describing. Those who have been dead, who are raised, and who reign with Christ. Now, you could say, but now wait a second. In Revelation chapter 20, those who are raised are already saints. Well, I grant that it's not a perfect relationship, right? But I think what Paul is saying in Ephesians chapter 2 is basically the same as what John is saying in Ephesians. Let me back up. I think what Paul is saying in Ephesians chapter 2 is basically the same thing that John is seeing in Revelation chapter 20. And that is, God's people are those who, though they may die, are yet alive with Christ. They are raised with Christ out of the death of sin and reign with Him. And so from my standpoint, and again, maybe this is a misunderstanding on my part, I would say, broadly speaking, the first resurrection and the new birth, or the second birth that we talked about, are the same event. Okay? Now, there are subtle differences that we could develop if we were doing that kind of a study. For instance, I would say that one of the purposes of the first resurrection in Revelation chapter 20 is to show you that despite the devil's efforts to destroy the church survives. The church is raised. The church persists. And that's why you have saints who have been killed physically who are raised and reign with Christ. So I'm not suggesting that it's exactly parallel in every respect. There are some nuanced differences. But broadly speaking, I would say that the first resurrection is akin to the second birth. It's the new birth. Does that make sense? Is that clear? And so then, born twice, if you are born physically and reborn spiritually, you're raised with Christ and reigning with Christ, then you only die once, right? But if you're only born once, you only are born physically, you're never reborn of the Spirit, well, then you die twice. Mm-hmm. Your body dies, and then your soul is cast into hell, okay? So that's the point that I wanted to clarify. Yeah. Does that help?
That helps, yeah.
Okay, questions about that? Yes, Nancy.
The second resurrection.
Yes. That would be, right here, the general resurrection of the dead.
first one is
yes.
when the soul...
I believe so. Yeah, so in Revelation chapter 20, and again, this is where we get into the nuanced differences between the first resurrection and the new birth, okay? And admittedly, this is where the two kind of diverge a little bit. In Revelation chapter 20, those who are already saints, who are put to death for Christ's sake, are raised in order to reign with Christ. But it doesn't say that they are raised bodily. It doesn't say that they're raised physically. It doesn't say that they reign on earth. You can make an argument that that is the nature of resurrection in Revelation. That's the argument that's made for multiple bodily resurrections by premillennialists. But I'm not convinced that the evidence supports that, actually. I think it's a spiritual resurrection. Now, what's the difference between the second birth, the new birth, and that first resurrection? Well, you could say they've already been born again on earth. They are killed, and yet they reign with Christ. But I think the whole point is they've already been raised with Christ. Though he may die, yet he shall live. That's what Jesus says in John 11, standing at Lazarus' tomb, right? I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, martyrs in Revelation chapter 20, yet shall he live. They reign with Christ. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die, right? So whoever believes in me, though he may die, yet shall he live. There is a spiritual resurrection, that first resurrection, and the one who lives and believes in me will never die. He will never experience that spiritual death in hell, right? Lynn?
So is that first resurrection to us immediately after we die, and then we wait, and then we get our...
I think in one sense, yes. Yeah, if you wanted to interpret Revelation 20 very, very literally, very, very, almost rigidly, then yes, you would say, when they are killed on earth, they are raised with Christ. But I would argue that Ephesians 2 is suggesting that that's really what's already happened. Before you die, you are raised from death in sin to reign with Christ.
Right, already guaranteed it.
Exactly. And so that what's actually happening at your death prior to the resurrection day is you are simply experiencing the union with Christ in his presence that you already enjoy right now out of his presence. Right? So that's why I would say there is a distinction between these two events, the first resurrection and the new birth, but it's not a big difference. It's a little bit of a distinction. It's not a big difference because essentially the first resurrection is just the present experience of that which is absent experience right now, right? To be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. To be present with the body is right now to be absent from the Lord, and yet... Ephesians 2, we are already with the Lord. We are already raised. We are already reigning. We are already united to Christ. That's why we have the forgiveness of sins. And so what we experience at our death is that we get to go and be with Christ in the Spirit, where right now we are not with Christ in that way, in that present way, and yet we are. We are united to Christ invisibly, though absent. Does that make sense? Is this thousand-year reign in Revelation chapter 20. Every other reference to a thousand years in the Bible is agreed by all Christians not to refer to the millennium. Obviously, all of us believe that the millennium is referred to in other parts of the Bible, but not in that way, not by that name. So this is the only place where it's referred to as a thousand-year period, right? The reign of Christ, the kingdom of Christ. And whether that's going to be an earthly kingdom, whether that's going to be a spiritual kingdom, whether that is still in the future, whether that is a present reality, we're going to look at those different views. And then we're going to spend most of our time permitting, talking about this idea of dispensationalism and dispensational premillennialism, because that is by far the most common perspective on the end times today. And I want to just give you some sense of what it is. And because many of you have been taught it without even knowing by that name, so that you can recognize it, not to say that it is heretical in any way. This is a position held by Orthodox Christians, but it is different than what you'll hear in our church. So I want you to at least know what the differences are, okay? Dispensational premillennialism that we're going to talk about in just a little bit believes that with regard to, really, God's dealings with mankind in general, that the church... and Israel are two separate groups. They are distinct peoples of God. And that he has different plans for Israel and the church. That previously, God's focus was on Israel. And whenever a dispensationalist talks about Israel, they mean ethnic Israel. They mean national Israel. They don't mean spiritual Israel, right? That's only something that us weird Reformed Christians talk about, right? Dispensationalist, when he says Israel, he means the Jews, the Jewish people, okay? And so previously God focused his attention upon Israel. Right now in the church age, he's focusing upon the church, which is predominantly Gentile. But then he's going to shift his focus and again focus on the Jewish people. Dispensationalism, with regard to their view of the millennium, says that the church will be secretly raptured. And secretly just means invisibly. It's going to suddenly happen, you know, the left behind idea, right, that Tim LaHaye wrote about. That's a kind of a classic formulation of this idea that one day God is going to just snatch, which is what rapture means, right? He's going to snatch up the church. All the believers are going to be gone, and then the world will enter into a period of tribulation that's usually thought to be 7 years. After the tribulation, Christ will return, and he will establish a 1,000-year reign at Jerusalem. And then there will be a final rebellion, and then the end will come, and we will enter into the eternal state and glory. Okay? Now, what I say at the bottom of this handout, I don't want you to misunderstand. When I say this view is not consistent with the Westminster Standards, that does not mean that it is heretical. That does not mean that people are lost if they believe this. And it does not mean that you cannot be a member of this church and believe this. In fact, arguably many of our members believe this very thing. In the OPC, and I think this is exactly the right way to do it, in the OPC, you are not required to agree with the Westminster Confession of Faith in order to be a member of the church. Only the officers, deacons, elders, ministers take vows saying, yes, I do believe that the Westminster Confession of Faith and its catechisms describe the system of doctrine that is taught in Scripture, right? So I'm not believing the Westminster Confession instead of Scripture, but I'm saying I think that what Scripture teaches is broadly summarized in the Westminster Confession. So officers are not going to be dispensational premillennialists in the OPC because those views cannot be reconciled. However, many members in churches in our denomination are dispensationalists, and that's fine. I don't want you to misunderstand what I'm saying there at all, okay? Barbara.
Where it says you will reign 1,000 years, yes, in Jerusalem, that indicates it would be on earth.
That's exactly right. It is an earthly kingdom, and it is a literal 1,000-year period, right? Not a figure, but an actual dating, right? A time period, okay? And I think, by the way, this is what the vast majority of you probably have been taught, have been exposed to. I hope that you do not feel that I'm in any way disrespectful to that view. Like I said, this is where, you know, my academic training has come from largely. I have many friends who are in that camp. I love and respect those brothers and sisters, and they are convinced that I am going to hang my head in shame as we are raptured. And no joke, they joke with me about this, and I'd love to be wrong about that, okay? Nancy.
How do you reconcile the two different peoples?
Yes.
Which we don't, but with being grafted in.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah.
One tree.
Exactly. I want to come back to this in just a minute, but what Nancy is referring to is exactly right. Romans chapter 11 talks about the believers, the believing Gentiles being grafted into the stock of Israel and unbelieving Jews being cut out. So let me just say this real quickly. One of the critiques that is offered by dispensationalists against covenant theology, which is what I believe the Scriptures teach. And this is a critique that I believe is unfair. It is a straw man. It's a misrepresentation of covenant theology. Is they will say, you believe in replacement theology. You believe that God's people were the Jews, and now God has replaced the Jews with the church. I do not believe that. Reformed Christians do not teach that. That's not what the Bible teaches, obviously. But here's what I do believe. I don't believe that there are two different people groups. I believe that there's one people of God under one covenant of grace, and that encompasses both Jews and Gentiles. And that as believers, whether they're Jews or Gentiles, as believers trusting Christ, they are grafted into that root, right, to that branch growing out of the root of the patriarchs and the faith of the patriarchs and the promises of God. And as Jews or Gentiles who are born into that covenant community reject Christ, they are cut out. So I don't believe anybody's connected to God's people merely because of biology, merely because of ancestry, right? If my children do not trust in Jesus Christ, they will not be saved. It doesn't matter that they're the child of a pastor. It doesn't matter that they've been baptized. It doesn't matter that they go to church. Why is that true of my children and it's not true of the Jewish people? If they don't believe in Jesus, then they're not part of the people of God. And I think Romans chapter 11 makes it very, very clear there is one people group. There is one people, one root, one branch, and faith is the determining factor as to who is included and who is excluded. Right? Okay, Debbie.
Isn't Jesus the new covenant? He's the new Adam.
He is the new Adam. That's right.
Right.
And at the same time, that new covenant is the fulfillment and consummation of all of the promises that God has made and all the covenants, right, that we see before. Yeah. Okay. So we will come back to this in just a minute. I'm just giving you kind of a broad overview here. Let's go to the next view of the millennium, which is historical or historic. Sometimes you'll hear it, premillennialism. Now, one thing to note is that dispensationalists typically conflate these two. So they will just refer to premillennialism. But they will talk about pre-trib premillennialism and post-trib premillennialism. What that refers to is there going to be a secret rapture of the church prior to the tribulation? Dispensationalists say yes. Historic premillennialists say no. And so usually a dispensationalist will just refer to historic premillennialism as post-trib premillennialism. But that really is a little bit confusing because dispensationalism is very, very different than historic premillennialism. Historic premillennialism goes all the way back to at least the second century, by the way. Irenaeus in the mid-100s AD is writing about historic premillennialism. So if you want to say, I'm going to be a premillennialist regardless of what my pastor says, you are in good company, right? There are many faithful Christians for many, many years, right? Now, amillennialism goes all the way back to the Apostle Paul. No, I'm just kidding. But anyway, actually, I'm not kidding. I think it does, but nonetheless. But you're on good ground, right? Historic premillennialism is well attested in the early church fathers. It is compatible with the Westminster Standards. I know of at least two men in our presbytery who are historic premillennialists. And so, you know, it is a very well attested view, at least historically. Historic premillennialism says the church is the Israel of God. And it includes both Jews and Gentiles who believe in Jesus Christ. That's what I believe, right? That's what I believe. But that's not what dispensationalism says. Dispensationalism says, nope, two different groups, right? Historic premillennialism recognizes there's one people of God. Historic premillennialism says the church and the world will go through a period of tribulation, a great tribulation, after which Jesus will return and establish a literal earthly reign over his kingdom. Okay, so they do believe it will be an earthly kingdom. They do believe that Jesus will literally reign at Jerusalem, but they don't believe that there will be an invisible rapture. They don't believe in multiple resurrections, usually. They don't believe that the church will be absent from the tribulation, and they don't believe that the Jews and the church are two different groups. They believe that God's people are all who trust in Jesus Christ, whether Jews or Gentiles. Okay? All right, a third view is postmillennialism. And I'm going to talk in just a minute about how even these terms and these names and categories are a little bit anachronistic to talk about this in terms of church history, but we'll talk about that in a second. Postmillennialism is the idea that Christ will return after the millennium. So you see, pre-millennium, he returns before the millennium. Postmillennialism, he returns after the millennium. Do you understand how that works, right? Pre is before, post is after, millennium is 1,000 years. Postmillennialism believes that society will be gradually improved and transformed by the preaching of the gospel through the witness of the church and cultural engagement by Christians. The gates of hell will not prevail against the church, but instead the church will actually overcome the forces of wickedness. So you notice Jesus says in Matthew 16, the gates of hell or Hades shall not prevail against the church. Well, whose gates are under attack there? Well, it's the gates of hell. It's not the gates of the church, even though it feels like it's the gates of the church, right? It's the gates of hell that are under attack, and those gates will not stand. So in other words, the idea is that the church will overcome all adversaries, and the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as water covers the seas, Isaiah 11:9. This view is very common among Reformed Christians. It is certainly compatible with the Westminster Standards. Postmillennialism fell out of favor, really, in the mid-20th century, early to mid-20th century, after two world wars. Prior to that, the vast majority of Reformed Christians were postmillennialists, and it was certainly the dominant view. After the Second World War, it kind of, you know, was a little bit difficult to be a postmillennialist, and to how do you reconcile this idea that society's gradually improving when actually, no, we're developing, you know, atomic bombs and dropping them on Japan and keep finding ourselves embroiled in conflict. Now, quite honestly, that is an unfair critique. That's an unfair critique of postmillennialism, right? I say that it's wrong for the dispensationalists to interpret Revelation through whatever's going on in the news right now, right? Well, it's not fair for me to then critique postmillennialism in the same way and say, well, but have you seen what's happening in the world? That's not really fair, right? But postmillennialism did kind of decline in terms of its popularity at that time. Now, in the latter part of the 20th century and the early part of the 21st century, postmillennialism is roaring back. I have got a lot of friends who are postmillennial. And so I think a lot of people are recognizing that there is a strong case to be made for postmillennialism. And so more and more Christians are embracing that. Audra.
Where is all this improvement going to come from?
The church.
If we have had Christ on earth and could not change things for 2,000 years, where is this other help coming from?
Well, I think the postmillennialists would say, do you believe that the coming of Christ should make a visible difference in the world? I think all of us would say, yes, of course, right? Do we believe that the preaching of the gospel will accomplish the purpose that God intends for it? Yes, I believe so. Do you believe that the Spirit and his power and influence is greater than the forces of darkness that prevail right now? Yes, I believe so. Postmillennialists would say, there you go, right? So that's the way that you would develop the argument. Obviously, there's a lot more you could say about it. I'm not a postmillennialist, right? So obviously, I'm not convinced of this perspective. I want to be fair to all of the perspectives. I want to treat all of them with respect. But it's not my position, so I would obviously believe that there are some weaknesses to it, but it certainly a case can be made. A case can be made. Nancy.
Do they believe that the church without Christ will overcome wickedness? I'm having trouble with that.
Okay, so postmillennialists, this is where you get into kind of the nuanced differences among postmillennialists, right? So some postmillennialists will believe that yes, Christ will be absent through this kind of gospelization, right, of and Christianization of the culture, and then others that Christ will come back at some point there, and then that might be consummated. But they just believe that through the preaching of the gospel and through calling men to faith in Jesus Christ, you are going to see not every person on earth become a Christian, but broadly speaking, you are going to see Christian culture and influence. I would argue that you've already seen that. I would argue that that is the story of the Western tradition. And I would argue that that is the history and heritage that Western Europe, Canada, and now the United States of America has basically spat upon, thrown into the dirt, and stomped upon. Right? Yeah. So I think we had kind of Christian cultural influence for most of the medieval period and post-Reformation period. Right. Exactly. Yeah. So because I'm an amillennialist, right, which is where we're going next, I believe that the gospel is going to make progress in the present age, and that evil will persist as well, right? So I'm not a pessimist in the sense that a dispensationalist might be. You know, things are just going to get worse and worse and worse and worse until finally God just says enough is enough and he takes the church out, right? Well, I don't believe that. I believe that God is going to exercise influence on human society, culture, through the preaching of the gospel, the witness of the church. But I also believe that the devil is the prince of the power of the air. The whole world lies under the sway of the wicked one, and that will continue to be true until the return of Jesus.
And
so,
if the society was going to be improved by, transformed by Christians through the preaching of the gospel, wow, we all should be saved, because with all the electronic information we get,
sure,
all the Bibles available,
sure,
you know,
well,
it's
but
just, it's everywhere.
Again,
you're looking for it.
I don't want to sound today like I'm trying to convince you of postmillennialism. I just feel obligated to be fair to it. I think if I were a postmillennialist, though, Lynn, I would say that is itself evidence of postmillennialism. Look at the fact that every one of you has got a phone in your pocket or your purse where you have, I mean, my phone has like 1,000 Bible translations on it in almost every language spoken around the world, right? How is that possible? Every one of you probably has that, or most all of you, the Bible app, you know, and that the church and the gospel is, you know, growing like wildfire in South America, in China, in Africa. What's happening is the center of Christianity is shifting. South Korea is sending missionaries to America, right? I mean, so yeah. And when you start to see some of those things, you say, oh, you know, and I think part of what it is we tend to look at the news and you know, what if it bleeds, it leads, right? What does the news focus upon? It's not positive stories. It's not, you know, cultural influence by the church. It's everything that illustrates human depravity. And so we think, oh, you know, things are just awful right now. Well, remember, we live in a 24-hour news cycle where when any bad thing happens in any part of the world, you can know it within 30 minutes, right? And then be reminded of it every half hour, right? Over and over and over. But that's not the whole story of what's going on. You look at the reports on foreign missions from a denomination as small as the OPC. I mean, really, how small and insignificant is the OPC? And yet you look at the reports on foreign missions and the things that are being done in other parts of the world and the way that the gospel is growing even in what ought to be closed countries, well, you could understand why somebody would say, I think God is pushing back the gates of hell, right? He's pushing back the forces of darkness. We can hope and pray. I mean, again, in some ways, I would love to be wrong about all of these things, right? I would love to say, hey, secretly raptured sounds good to me. I'm out of here, right? Literal earthly reign for 1,000 years? That sounds great. Sign me up for that, right? The church evangelizes the whole world and the whole world becomes at least ostensibly Christian? I want to raise kids then, you know? I mean, that sounds great in so many ways. But I'm an amillennialist because I think that's what the Bible teaches, okay? So an amillennial position says that the millennium described in Revelation chapter 20 is the entire period between the two advents of Christ. So the word advent just means coming, right? So the first coming of Christ and the second coming, the last coming of Christ. That it especially in the context of Revelation focuses upon that period after the persecutors of the church have been judged. The Jews and the Romans at the beginning of the church's history try to stamp it out, and yet the church prevails and the church reigns with Christ, right? But we are right now reigning with Christ, that Christ is reigning over a real kingdom, but it is a spiritual kingdom. So just like a Reformed view of the Lord's Supper would say, is Christ really present when we partake of the Lord's Supper? Yes, but spiritually. Not real presence the way that the Roman Catholics would believe in the transubstantiation of the bread and the wine. Not even the real presence that Lutherans would believe in, where through consubstantiation, Christ is in with and under the elements themselves, right? No, we believe that Christ is spiritually present. But does that mean that he's just kind of, it's just kind of symbolic? No. We believe it's a real communion with Christ. So that's what distinguishes a Reformed view of the Lord's Supper from, for instance, most Baptists and any Baptistic kind of church, a lot of non-denominational churches as well. They would take what's called the memorial view. And they would say, well, you know, it's not that Christ is really present in any way, but as we eat the bread and we drink the grape juice and we think about Jesus, then we are kind of communing with him in that sense. I would say, well, as a Reformed Christian, I think it's a lot more than that. I mean, Jesus says, this is my body, this is my blood of the new covenant, and, you know, as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, I mean, there is communion happening here, right? But it's spiritual. It's not the physical body of Christ. It's not the physical presence of Christ. And I would say that the kingdom that is described in Revelation chapter 20, the millennial reign, is the same thing. It's real. But it's spiritual. It's not earthly, and it's not literally 1,000 years. I mean, as it is, it's been about 2,000 years. By the way, amillennialism goes back right to the early church as well, just like historic premillennialism does. You could argue as to whether postmillennialism does. A postmillennialist would say, of course, it does. It is very common among Reformed Christians, and it is certainly consistent with the Westminster Standards. Okay. Now, on the next chart, what I've done is just given you, and I think I showed you this at the end of the last week's class, is kind of a, and it's a very, very sketchy chart, but for whatever it's worth, kind of a side-by-side comparison in timeline form of these four different views. So what is called at the top, I'm sorry, yes, Barbara.
Before we move on.
Yeah, yes, please.
The post-millennium
yes.
makes a statement, is consistent with the Westminster Standards.
Yes.
And then on the homilism, it's is consistent with Westminster.
Yes. And so is historic premillennialism, because the Westminster Confession does not teach a specific view with regard to these questions. But what it does teach is not consistent with dispensationalism, but could be consistent with any of the other three views. Okay. So this is one of the things that I want to kind of reinforce at this point. I appreciate you asking that question because it helps me underline this. On this chart, and this is not the order I would have placed them in, number one at the top, post-tribulational premillennialism, that's just what we're calling historic premillennialism, okay? Below that, pre-tribulational premillennialism, that's dispensational premillennialism. And then you have post-millennialism and you have amillennialism. What I want you to recognize, and because of the way that the views are placed in order here, it's not helpful, but if you could just take out dispensationalism for a moment and you look at post-trib premillennialism, post-millennialism, and amillennialism, their charts look almost exactly the same. Do you see that? Mm-hmm. The only difference is historic premillennialism is going to say there is going to be a literal earthly reign of Christ. Post-millennialism is going to say maybe there will be, maybe there won't be. But basically what's happening is the church is having influence on the culture, and that will usher in the millennium. Okay. And amillennialism says everything since the resurrection and ascension of Jesus until he comes back again, that's the millennium, right? But in terms of how many events and things like that are happening in between, there's not much difference. Historic premillennialism, amillennialism, and postmillennialism are like this. They are side by side. They overlap so much that this is the reason that officers in the OPC or the PCA and different Reformed denominations can say, I affirm the system of doctrine taught in the Westminster Confession of Faith, and all three of them can, because there is far more agreement than disagreement. Okay? Far more agreement. Now, quite honestly, as we said last week, there are really only two views, if you will, of the question of Christ's return in relation to the millennium. Everybody's either premillennial or postmillennial. Okay? So an amillennialist and a postmillennialist believes that Jesus will return after the millennium. And a historic premillennialist and a dispensationalist believes that Jesus will return before the millennium. So this is why I say that to some extent it's a bit anachronistic to talk about these terms and categories in a sharp distinction. Dispensationalism really developed around 1830. We can date when this started, right? With J.N. Darby and then C.I. Schofield and the Schofield Reference Bible, and it was promoted through that, and then the influence of institutions like Dallas Theological Seminary in the mid and latter part of the 20th century, the work of men like Charles Ryrie and Zane Hodges and others. Dispensationalism is the newcomer on the block. That doesn't mean it's wrong, but it is definitely different than the other views. But historically, even all the way back to the early church, there are not clearly defined camps, okay, where you say, I'm an amillennialist, well, I'm a postmillennialist, well, I'm a premillennialist. Quite honestly, amillennialism and postmillennialism weren't even distinguished from one another until the latter part of the 19th century, maybe the 20th century. They just all kind of agreed Jesus is coming back after the millennium. And then you had some who said that who were more optimistic. They said, yeah, and I think before he comes back, the church is going to be largely Christianized, or the world, rather, is going to be largely Christianized. And others that were a little bit more pessimistic and saying, well, I'm not sure about that. I think that the church and good and the world and evil is going to kind of run side by side until he returns. Well, that's what became this disagreement. That's what became postmillennialism, optimistic postmillennialism, as opposed to amillennialism, which is just a little bit pessimistic postmillennialism, right? So we're speaking a little bit anachronistically when we talk about these categories through church history. I will say this. The early Christians did debate whether Christ would return before the millennium and it would be on earth, or whether he would return after the millennium and it would be a spiritual kingdom. They did debate that. So that's why I say, historically, there are really two positions. Are you premillennial or are you postmillennial? In that sense, I'm postmillennial. But in our more contemporary discourse, my position would be described as amillennialism. Does that make sense? All right, so what we'll do next week then, Lord willing, is we will talk a little bit about dispensationalism as a theological system, right? And that's really, I think that it will be helpful, again, not in any way to try to disrespect dispensationalism as a perspective or dispensationalists as brothers and sisters in Christ, but to simply say this is the default view of the majority of evangelical Christians today. To such an extent, as I related last week again and have mentioned before, a man that I was discipling comes in and says, you know, I heard this crazy thing on the radio, this pastor that believes that Jesus is already reigning and that we're already in the millennium. And I'm like, yeah, that's what I believe. And just the horror on his face. I mean, you could see it was like I had denied the Trinity, you know, because all he had ever been exposed to was dispensationalism. Okay. Now, at the end of our study and at the end of, you know, the day, you may say, I still think that dispensationalism is true. Okay, that's fine, you know. John MacArthur describes himself as a leaky dispensationalist. That's how he refers to it. And I love John MacArthur, right? And I'm sure that John MacArthur will be so much closer to the throne of God in glory. You know, we won't be in the same zip code. I'll be standing so far back. But I do think that there are some problems with dispensationalism. And there is a reason that I don't think the Bible teaches it. I want you to at least be aware of the distinctive features and some of the critiques that you will hear. And then if at the end of the day you say, you know what, I'm going to disagree with Pastor on that, that's okay. That's all right, right? But at least you'll be able to do so in an informed way. We'll also talk about how many resurrections there are, which is a major question with regard to dispensationalism, and tie off a few things like that, okay?